Okay, so let's get started here. So last time we were talking about remote procedure calls, and specifically we were discussing the issue of what happens when there are either client or server failures, and that's where we stopped. So let me reiterate the failure semantics in the case of client failure. So the problem here is the client has made a request to the server. It sent an RPC request. The server is executing this request. Assume that this is a long-lived request. There's no limit that has been imposed on the length of time it takes for this remote procedure to execute. It can take arbitrary amounts of time. So let's assume that it's a long-running remote procedure call and the client process crashes while the server is executing. And the question is, what should the server do? How should it deal with this issue? So typically, if a client process crashes, you want to somehow stop the computation. You don't want to keep processing the request, waste CPU cycles, because there is no one to send the response to. Okay, so question is, how would you do this in a reasonable way? So we will refer to a server computation as an orphan if the client that requested this computation crashed. So this is an orphan computation. There's no one that's requesting it that's still alive. Okay. So there are four ways to deal with it. The first one is called extermination. So in this case, every time the client makes an RPC call, you log that in a disk. Okay, so you write that request to a file, so you have a record of what has been requested. Okay? And if the client crashes, then some other runtime system can actually look at the log file and look at all the computations that are still ongoing, and then terminate them by sending an appropriate request to the server. Okay? So this is basically what's called extermination. You explicitly kill orphans. And the way you do this is you need to keep track of which requests have even been made, because the server process is on some remote machine. The way you do this is you basically keep a log in a file, which is not going to disappear if a client process crashes. So you keep a record on persistent storage. Okay? This has the overhead of maintaining a disk log. Specifically, every time you make a function call, you have to write a record to disk, which may slow down your computation. Okay? Reincarnation is basically saying that you can take time and divide it into epochs. An epoch may be of arbitrary length. Okay, just assume that epochs are 10 seconds in length. Pick a length, and you have time that's divided into epochs. And what happens is, when you move into a new epoch, you basically take all the computations that are still ongoing from the previous epoch and you terminate them. Okay? So typically, epochs have to be significantly longer than the length of RPC requests, so you don't terminate requests unnecessarily. Okay, so that's basically what it says. And gentle incarnation is a variant of reincarnation, which says if you are starting a new epoch, don't go and just start terminating all ongoing RPC computations. First check if the corresponding clients that requested them are alive. If so, there is no reason to terminate that computation. The client is still waiting for a response. So only kill computations that are left over, meaning which have no owner. And to do this, you have to broadcast, the server has to broadcast a request saying, if you have made an RPC request and you are waiting on hearing from this process, please reply saying you are alive. And if you don't hear from certain clients, those computations are terminated. So here you don't check, you just say new epoch started, let me start afresh. It's like almost like I restarted the service with all the old state, all the old computations have gone. In this the other case, you are actually checking first, and you delete only if there is no owner, the question is.
So with reincarnation, how does it help with the problem of orphaning? Because if the epoch is longer than your normal computation time, it has already finished computation, tried to send it back and realized the client isn't there and could have deleted then. So why is it breaking up into epochs at all?
Right. So if your computation is actually finished, then the fact that the epoch hasn't ended doesn't help you. Right? So only helps when it sort of is doing the cleanup. So you may have basically sent a request. So what would happen in this case is you may actually send a reply to the client, which doesn't exist. and you never hear from an acknowledgement. So you're just waiting, saying, has it received it? Not. You may be doing retransmissions, as we had looked at in the previous slide. It says, if the replies are lost, you time out and you retransmit. So you may keep retransmitting it, not knowing whether the network is not delivering your message or whether the client is dead. You don't know. You cannot distinguish between the two. So at when the epoch ends, you give up, saying, I'm not going to retransmit anymore. I'm just going to stop. That's all it is doing. But otherwise, it will keep retrying to contact the client. Okay. Now, this will not occur if there is TCP, because if the client crashes and you have a TCP connection, the connection is broken down by the underlying OS. So you know that the client has crashed. But if you are using UDP for your RPC system, you don't know. There's no explicit connection between the client and the server, no state. The last technique that is used is called expiration. So here, whenever a new RPC request starts, it has a timeout value associated with it. Okay? The length of the computation exceeds the timeout value. At that point, you have to check, saying, is the client alive and is it still interested in hearing a reply? If so, then you increase the timeout by another duration of T seconds. Okay? And you keep doing this. So what happens here is, in long-running computation, you periodically pause the computation and check with the client, saying, are you alive? Yeah, and if so, then I'm going to do T more seconds of computation and then check again. And if at any point you don't hear back from the client, you assume that the client has crashed, and then you terminate the computation. Okay. So you basically have an expiration time for the RPC request. You keep extending the expiration time if the client is alive. And if not, when the expiration time passes by, you kill the computation. Okay. This ensures that you will not have any computations for which there are no clients. Okay? So what happens here is there's an overhead of making periodic checks with the client during long computation. So that overhead gets added to the runtime system overhead. Okay? So now we have looked at all possible scenarios: client crashing, server crashing, reply messages getting lost, request messages getting lost. And if you implement all of this, you will have an RPC system that can deal with any arbitrary failure. Okay? So when you design an RPC system, you have to decide what semantics to provide, and then what are some of the mechanisms, and some subset of what we talked about you will have to implement in an RPC system. Okay? So now let's look at some implementation issues. So if you are designing your RPC system, what are things you need to think about? Okay? The most important issue is the efficiency of the RPC system itself. Okay. And the efficiency will depend on several things, including what protocol the RPC system, the client stub and the server stub, are going to use for communication. Okay. Now, the choice of the protocol is up to the designer of the RPC system. Since this is completely transparent to the application programmer, you can choose whatever is most suitable for that RPC system. And the programmer doesn't know whether what you are using. And in most cases, if you provide the right semantics, shouldn't even care. Okay? So there are various possibilities. The simplest one is to use either UDP or TCP. Okay, just use the standard protocols that are available to you, rather than designing one from scratch. Okay? Now, if you use UDP, you have to deal with failures at the RPC system, runtime system level. Within the stubs, you have to have code to deal with failures. Because UDP is not going to handle lost messages on the network. It doesn't guarantee message delivery. Yeah, unlike TCP, which will retransmit and make sure your message gets through even if the network drops packets. Okay, UDP does not make those guarantees. So if the stub has actually sent a message to the other end, if it gets lost, you have to have code in the stub to deal with that. Have timeouts and retransmits. If you use TCP, on the other hand, the stub code becomes significantly simpler, because TCP provides a reliable channel. Okay, it is dealing with the problem of lost packets. It is giving you the abstraction of a lossless channel, a reliable lossless channel. Anything that is sent on one end will be received at the other end, so long as both endpoints are alive. If the process crashes, then there is no guarantee. But so long as the process hasn't crashed, there is nothing the RPC runtime has to do. So then the RPC system, or the stub code that you have to generate from your RPC compiler, is simplified. Okay, all of this has implications on what stub code you have to generate automatically. Okay. So there are other issues like packet size restrictions. Okay, depending on the protocol you choose, there may be a maximum length on the packet. that the protocol imposes. Now this has implications on when you send your original request, okay, or you get back a reply. If the data that you have to send is large, then it may have to be packetized. You have to chop it up into smaller packets and send them, all of which will increase latency and also increase the chances that any one packet will be lost. Because for instance, if your parameter is a large array, okay, and this array is not going to fit in one packet, you will have to, in the stub, chop it up into smaller packets and send it out. Okay? Or the reply value is a large struct, and if that struct will not fit into a packet, you have to do the same thing on the way back. Okay? So there are issues that are like that you have to deal with. There's flow control issues, but they're not very relevant here. That just says if you are sending large amounts of data, the rate at which you send it may have to be governed by the conditions in the network. Okay? Now again, if you use TCP, this will be taken care of for you. Okay? But if you are using UDP, you just start blasting packets into the network and you cause congestion at the router will start dropping your packets. So by sending packets at a rate that's faster than what the network can accommodate, given current load conditions, you are actually increasing the probability of packet drops of your own flow. Okay? So you might have to implement flow control in the RPC stuff, which says this is the right rate at which you should be sending packets, or between packets have some interval where you don't send, so you can actually send at a rate where packets get across with a much higher probability. So several things that you would have assumed the transport protocol will take care of, you might have to deal with at in the stub if you choose something simpler, okay, like UDP, which may not provide a lot of this support for it. Okay, that's one issue that which has implications on efficiency. The other issue is the copying costs. Okay? Because you are actually copying at multiple levels, okay, from the function that is being called into the stub, from the stub to the OS, and from the OS into the device and so on, you have to actually pay some attention to what kind of overheads this will impose and what implications it has on throughput of your system. Okay? So typically, if you don't do anything, if you just do the standard things, just use vanilla sockets and implement your RPC system, you will have at least two message copies and as many as seven. Okay? So if you, let's say you make a function call and you specify some arguments, okay, how many times are those arguments copied from one buffer to another before they go to the endpoint? Okay? So you have to first copy it from your call function into the stub, because the stub is preparing a message that is going to send out. So that's a buffer. You copy it there, okay, into the buffer in the stub. From there you make a call, a socket send or a receive. So that's a system call that copies it from the application address space into the OS address space. Okay? And the OS actually hands it to the device driver, okay, which will copy it onto the hardware, okay, onto the Ethernet NIC, which has some memory. Okay, so you copy it to the NIC and say send, and then the NIC is actually going to start putting bits on the wire. Okay, so that's another copy, that the NIC is actually copying bits onto the medium of the wire. It arrives at the other end, assume one hop. Okay, if there are multiple hops, then there are intermediate copies. But if there's one hop, they arrive at the NIC at the other end. Okay, so bits are coming onto the wire and you copy them into a buffer on that hardware device. And then the hardware device signals the kernel, and the kernel then takes the data from the device, copies it into kernel memory. Okay. Then it has to dereference, figure out which endpoint is this data for. Okay. It has to figure out what's the socket to which this data has been delivered. And then once it figures out the socket, there's a process ID associated with it. So you find the right process, and then you hand it over to that application. Okay, that's basically the stub in that application is listening for messages. This is the server stub. So it's going to copy that from the kernel. Okay, you're doing a receive, so that's a copy from the kernel address space back to the application. And from here, you will hand it to the procedure, okay, which is another call by value. So you will have all of these copying going on. And if you have large amounts of data that you're sending, then this is going to substantially impact throughput. Because memory copying can have large overheads depending on how much data is actually being copied. Okay, there are several optimizations to deal with it. This is not a problem specific to RPCs. Any application that requires lot of memory copies, ke copies from OS address space to application address space, vice versa, and copies within the application address space will have see impact on its performance. So there are many techniques that have been developed, which we are not going to talk about here. There's just one mentioned here called scatter gather. So basic point is, you can reduce the amount of data copying, performance improves. And this is something you have to keep track of as you write your RPC system, or for that matter, any distributed system. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so let me quickly talk about one case study, which is that of Sun RPC. So on most Unix flavored systems, Linux and whatnot, if you refer to RPC, then you are really talking about Sun's implementation of RPC, which has now become a de facto standard on most Unix-like platforms. Okay? Other platforms like Windows have their own implementations of RPCs that are somewhat different, but most Unix-like systems, okay, use this notion of RPC. So this was, it turns out, originally developed for use with network file system. That's the reason Sun actually implemented an RPC system to implement NFS. Okay. And then they realized that this can be used broadly for any distributed application. So they packaged it as an RPC system with a compiler that any developer can use to write programs that use RPC. Okay. Now it turns out that you can use Sun RPC with either UDP or TCP. You can use flags in the compiler to specify what you want to do. Okay, there are defaults, but you can override the defaults and say you want to use UDP or TCP. The original implementation of RPC actually used UDP. Okay. The reason for this was they wanted high performance. They didn't want performance to be impacted. And as we have seen in the last class, if you use TCP, before you can even send the first useful bit of data, you have this three-way handshake. Three packets have to be exchanged, three SYN packets to establish a connection. Okay? So that adds to the overhead of the system, it adds to the latency and can reduce throughput. In case of UDP, none of this is needed. You just open a socket and you say send. Okay? And then the data just goes out. There is no need to signal the other endpoint that you want to even establish a connection. So UDP is far more efficient than TCP. Because it, first of all, it avoids this handshake problem, and then there are all these other error recovery. None of that is actually taking place. So if you have a LAN environment where the probability of packet losses is low and the probability of channel errors is also low, going with UDP is the better choice for certain applications. Okay? So since NFS was originally designed as a network file system for a LAN, where there was a server sitting on a LAN and clients would mount volumes from that server and access remote files. That was the standard use case for that they had assumed for NFS, and for that UDP made sense. So their original implementation was of RPC was for UDP. But as people started using this RPC system for more than LAN applications, it was clear that you had to add TCP support. So later implementations of Sun RPC started using TCP. Okay, now I believe that most implementations will actually use TCP as the default. I'm not sure on every possible system, but most of them will likely use TCP as the default. And then you have to actually switch to UDP if you want it for your application. Okay. So there are certain differences between TCP and UDP, which will not go into it. It has to do with whether you have to do error control and how many retransmissions and whatnot. The only big difference is if you are actually using TCP, the stub doesn't have to deal with failures at the other side. Okay, because if either the server or the client crashes, the OS on that machine will tear down the connection for you. Because if the process crashes and the socket is associated with the process, all the process state is destroyed, including the socket. So then the other end is signaled that the socket is turned on. So you know that either the if you are a client, you know server has crashed or vice versa. Yes,
question there. Well, if the physical machine is crashed, it can't send a message. It's only if the program crashed.
Okay. The socket. So question is, what happens if the physical machine just hangs, okay, rather than the process crashing? So what TCP does is it sends these keep alive messages as a back channel. And if it doesn't get a response from the other end, it assumes the connection is torn off. So either you will be explicitly signaled that this connection has been terminated, or if the process just, not the process, the OS hangs or the server, the hardware just goes down, then TCP is actually at your end is tracking whether the other endpoint is alive. If there's no activity, it keeps sending this keep alive, doesn't hear anything back, it will tear it down. It is,
expiration, sending back and forth, seeing if it's still there.
Yes, so you will have this keep alive messages that you send on the TCP channel. So you use that to track whether the other end is alive. It's not expiration, but if you haven't heard from the other end, if there's no bytes have arrived, then you may, or if you are not, also you are not sending data, then you send these to figure out whether the other endpoint is alive. Okay, that's not an RPC thing, it's a TCP thing. Okay, so it uses marshalling of arguments as I talked about last time. Any complex data structure is linearized into a buffer and sent, and the marshalling rules tell you how to unpack that and reconstruct the struct or whatever data structure was packed into that buffer. Okay. It uses XDR representation, which is now a standard in itself. Okay, so any communication, because the hardware at the other end may not be the same as your hardware, you first translate all data you are sending into XDR format, and at the other end retranslate it back to your native format. So this is what all the stuff that you have to do. And the semantics that you provide is, actually there is no real semantics. If you have received a reply, it says it's at least once, which means that there was at least an attempt to execute the procedure. So the reply may be that there was an error or you get back a real reply. So that says at least one semantics. If you don't hear a reply back and you terminate the RPC call, then it says at least zero, which means that maybe it executed but something happened to the server after the execution. So really that means there's no semantics that it provides you that guarantees the exactly one semantics that would be the most appropriate one. So you have to guess based on what you're seeing, what might have happened. With UDP, it tries at most once, unless you actually reconfigure it to retransmit your request message. Okay, it's only going to try once. If it doesn't hear back, then it will just give up after a timeout value and return an error. Okay? But you could change that and say transmit k times before giving up, okay? Just in case the messages are lost. So that's how the system was implemented. And there are some other details that have to do with the directory service. So if you remember, what I said last time was there is a client and there is a server, and when the server starts up, it has to initially register with a directory service so that a client can locate what port it is listening on. Okay? On Unix machine, this is referred to as the port mapper process. Okay, so if you actually do a PS on any Linux box, you will actually see a process that's running, a daemon. It's called a port mapper. It's a directory service for RPC application. Any RPC application on that system registers itself with the port mapper. Okay. So the client basically has to, first time you make an RPC request, the stub has to go talk to the port mapper and figure out what port that server is listening on. And based on what comes back to you, you establish a connection. If it's TCP, or you just send a RPC request if it is UDP. Okay. And from that point on, this process is called binding. Okay, you're binding to the server. Once you are bound to the server, then you can just communicate subsequently without having to talk to the port mapper process. Okay. And I'll show some code, sample code next time. But when you register yourself, you have to specify a program ID and a version number. Okay. That has to be unique for that system. So you pick some large number that is known to be unique and you register yourself. So that's basically your program gets a numeric ID, and you can have different versions of the program, so you have also a version number. So if you come up with a new implementation of your service, you increment the version number as well. Okay. So the client has to basically, when it talks to the port mapper, it asks for the port number based on the program and the version number. So that's what it is storing here. So in the client startup code, there is this client create a call that basically tries to look for the server. Okay. Again, this is done by the stub. The programmer is not doing this. So when you actually look at the stub generated code, you will see this function. Then I'll show examples of all this in the next class. So that's basically the binding process in Sun RPC. Okay, similar techniques are used by other RPC system. Any questions? Okay, so the last thing that I want to mention is how Sun RPC works from a programmer standpoint. Okay, so that was basically how the internals of the system work. And so what the programmer have to do? So the programmer has to write a client part of the application and the server part. Okay, and then you also write a specification of the RPC routines in a special file which you give a .x extension. Okay, so this is your RPC spec. This is the code that you basically invoke using the RPC compiler, which on Sun RPC happens to be RPC gen. Okay. So you say RPC gen and you say foo.x. Then this generates four files for you. Okay. So this is the server part, so server stub, there's the client stub, there's a XDR file, and there's a header file. The XDR file, as the name suggests, is actually doing all of the translation. So these are standardized routines that take int and float and char and then translate them into XDR format. Okay. And the client and the server stub contain code which does all the marshalling of argument, looking up the port mapper, registering with the directory service. All of that code is either in the client stub or the server stub. Okay. So all of this is automatically generated. So all you have to do is then you take your client application, which is the main function and all of the RPC calls you make, and then you compile it and link it to these two files. Okay. You take the server application, you compile it and link it to the server stub and the XDR file. And you get two binaries at this point. Okay. And this you just use the standard C compiler, GCC or CC or whatever is your favorite compiler. You use that and then you get the two binaries. So you will see that a lot of the code you don't have to deal with. That's generated, you can see it, but you just have to link it to your application, not have to really worry about it. Yes, there's a question.
For migrating an existing application or using it with RPC, or is it like when you're starting from scratch, you have to...
Yes, when you write any RPC application, this is how you would write it. I'll show examples and put some on the web page also. So you write your client and server apps, okay, and you write them as function calls. So any communication from here to here is using RPC, okay, like what I shown last time. Okay, and then you take all of the RPC routines that the server is exporting and the client is using, and you write a spec file. This is almost like a header file, but it's in a special language called the IDL, Interface Definition Language. Okay. RPC gen is your IDL compiler. Okay. That basically takes the specification and creates the stubs for you. Okay. So that's how you write an RPC application. That's what this is showing.
Is it a graphical way to describe the specification, or
is there no graphical? No.
It's a big system or something like that.
No, there is nothing like that. I mean, I was playing around with it and I might have deleted that. Let me check. I will give a detailed example next time. Yeah, there is one here. Just a second. So here is a simple RPC .x file. Okay, there's a version number here. There's version number 1. And it has actually two routines, I think add and subtract. So there are two operands that are defined. And here is the actual specification of the server. Okay. This says that the server has two routines. There's an add and there's a subtract. Okay. So this is, and then this is the program number that I was talking about. This is a unique ID. That's the version number. Okay. So that's all you're specifying, really. And then when you run this to RPC gen, which we will actually do next time, you will see all of the files that automatically get generated from this simple specification. So here are, so you basically do RPC gen and then you give this file name, okay, and then it will generate all those files for you. So that's the way it works. I mean, there's no graphical interface, nothing. You just write some simple spec and it will. So we'll run through a real example next time. Is this clear? this is just a case study right now. Okay, so that's basically Sun RPC case study. There's some more things to look at in the context of RPCs. So what I'll do next is talk about some other RPC systems, and then we will, for the rest of this class, we'll talk about RMI, or how is this done in the Java world essentially, or any object oriented language. Okay, so let's start with lightweight RPCs. Okay. So our assumption thus far has been that you have a distributed application which consists of at least one client process, at least one server process. There may be more than one of each, and that these actually run on different machines. Okay. Now there are specialized scenarios where it may so happen that the client process and the server process run on the same machine. Okay. And you are just using RPC as a way to communicate between them. So the question then is, if in the special case where you run the client and the server on the same machine, can you somehow optimize the runtime overheads of the RPC system? Not have to pay all of the overheads that you have to pay when you generate the server stub and the client stub, you construct a message and you send it. All of that will still work. Okay, just fine. The issue is, do you need all of that machinery, and what can you remove and optimize and get better performance? So for this special case, people have developed what are called lightweight RPCs. They give the RPC abstraction, but they don't implement all of the things that you have in standard RPCs. Can I tell you, mention what the differences are? Okay. Like in RPCs, you have a server process and a client process. The server process exports its interface as remote procedures, registers itself. All of that is not changed. Okay. And the client process, when it starts up, has to bind to the server process. So that procedure doesn't change. But what has changed now is, because you know that the both processes are on the same machine, you don't use a full-fledged network protocol stack for communication. Okay. You will use some optimizations, and we'll see what those are. Okay. So this is how a lightweight RPCs might work. Okay. So just one way to do it. So assume that you are a client making an RPC call. So you push the arguments to the stack, okay, and then you basically make the RPC call at this point. So what happens now is, rather than constructing a message to be sent on a network, in which case it doesn't actually leave the machine, that message has just gone to the kernel and come back up to another process, okay, because both of the endpoints are on the same machine. So rather than doing that, what the kernel does is it takes a trap, and then it basically gives access to the client procedure, or rather gives access to the server procedure directly to the client. Okay. So here what happened is, you change the memory map of the client to the server address space. So the same process now gets access to the code that is loaded in the server. Okay. So you just take the function call and you start just execute the call. Okay. And then when you return, those page mappings are removed. So think of it as follows. So you make an RPC call. Okay, let's say you call function foo. This code for function foo resides in a server process. Okay. So rather than sending a message to the server saying execute this code and send back the result, the server, the OS simply takes a trap and just changes the page mapping so that the code for the foo process magically appears in your address space. So now you can just invoke it as a simple function call, as if that code has just appeared in your address space. You execute the procedure, get the result, and unmap those pages so they go back to the server address space, and you got the result. Okay. So just by fiddling around with some memory pages, you avoided the overhead of constructing a message, sending it to the server, getting a reply. Okay. And that will improve the performance of the system. Okay, there's a question
here.
Do all
OS support this? Is it required to actually take changes versus a specific block code?
Yeah. Question is, do all OS support it? They don't. I mean, this particular implementation is available in Solaris. It's called Doors. And the reason is, it almost looks like you make a call and there's a door opens to you to this process, and you get access to the code that resides in that process and you execute it. Okay, so this is implemented in Solaris, not in other operating system. But what it does tell you is, in this special case, and I'll show a picture here. the special case where both of the processes actually are on the same machine, you can optimize. You don't have to use a protocol stack for the client and the server to communicate. You basically fiddle with memory. Yeah, so this is basically how it works here. So you have to first register a door. The server process registers a door with the OS. The client process binds itself to the door. Okay? And then you can do a door call. At this point, what happens is you invoke a function in that server process and you get access to the code, because that call specifies an ID with it and a door name. So you basically get access to the server procedure. Okay? Then you access it, you execute it in your context, and then you go back to doing whatever you're doing. Okay? Now, in certain systems, there is a runtime bit that allows you to specify whether you want to use lightweight RPCs or standard RPCs. You can write the same code, not in case of doors, because here the interface is different from Sun RPC. The doors interface is not exactly the same as Sun RPC. But you could think of an RPC system where you use the same interface to write your client and the server. Okay? But you specify a bit which tells the runtime system, should it use standard RPCs and messages to communicate, or should it use a mechanism like this, which is essentially like using shared memory. It means both processes are on the same machine, they're just sharing memory between processes. In this case, they're sharing code between processes rather than sending messages. Okay? If you remember at the very first slide for this chapter, I said there can be unstructured communication. You can communicate using shared memory instead of messages. This is an example of that. Okay. So you can specify this bit and say use this at runtime or use the other one, and the same client and the server process can behave differently as far as the runtime system is concerned. Okay. So that's lightweight RPC. It's an optimization for this special case. And the other thing I want to mention, RPC semantics can also be different depending on what you are trying to do. What we have assumed so far is what we would call synchronous RPCs or blocking RPCs. So whenever a client makes a request to the server, the client process blocks until the server comes back with a result. Okay? So you make a function call and then the client process is going to block. And when the function call returns, the client process continues execution, it has the return value. Okay, so until this function foo is executed, you are blocking. That need not be the case in all RPC systems. There are several other semantics you could use for your RPC system, and there are three others mentioned here: asynchronous RPCs, deferred synchronous, and one-way RPC. And let me explain this with figures rather than text. So this is synchronous RPC. Your client, your server, black line indicate computation and dotted lines indicate waiting. Okay, so your client computing, it sends a request, it has blocked, server executes the procedure, sends a reply, client continues. Okay, standard synchronous RPCs. This is what asynchronous RPCs do. Here you send a RPC request to the server, and the server immediately sends an acknowledgement, and all that the acknowledgement tells you is that the request has been received, not that the request has actually executed and you have generated a reply. Okay. So here you are only blocking until you hear an ACK from the server saying you have received the request. So here you have this computation, send your RPC request, get an ACK saying the server received it, you continue execution, and the server asynchronously executes the procedure. Okay. Possibly at a later time, it doesn't even have to do it here, you can queue it and execute it later. Now you can ask how is the reply coming back? That's because the RPC call can generate a reply. You haven't waited for the reply. So you've just gone ahead and continue. So the reply has to be sent to you. Okay? And this could be done with another asynchronous RPC in the reverse direction. Yeah, that's what is shown in this picture here. So you have computation and then you make an RPC call, get an ACK, continue. The client, the server goes and executes this RPC call, generates a return value. Okay? And then it makes an RPC call, okay, saying these are the results for your call. And then you interrupt the client so it can receive the call. The client sends an acknowledgement. This is an asynchronous RPC in the reverse direction. Okay? It's actually initiated by the server back to the client. Client just acknowledges and the server is blocked until you hear the acknowledgement and you continue. Okay, so these are, it's called deferred synchronous RPCs. Yes.
Why do you have to wait for acknowledgement? You can't just send the request and wait till you receive the reply to see you're confusing?
Why do you have to wait for the acknowledgement? So the last point you raised is it's called one-way RPC. Okay. The client does not have to wait for an acknowledgement from the server. It just sends the request and it continues execution. The reason you have to include acknowledgements in the RPC system is we are not making any assumptions about the underlying protocol. Okay. If you by default, if you assume something like UDP, which does not guarantee reliable delivery, the acknowledgement actually tells you something. Here the acknowledgement tells you that the server has at least received your request. You don't have to retransmit or anything like that. Okay. You don't even wait for an acknowledgement, it's called one-way RPC. Just send a message, continue. You don't even know that the server has received the message in case of UDP. If it's TCP, the server will receive it. Okay. But because when we talk about semantics, we don't make any assumptions about how the system is implemented. We have to ensure that you have get certain semantics and they guarantee something. In this case, it's guaranteed the server has received it. In this case, you know that the client actually receives a reply in the other direction. Here, you don't. So that's the difference.
So, what if the server in the acknowledgement says cannot take the request at this point of time? So, does the client wait till the second request is made, or
how is? Okay, so you are saying if the server refuses to process your RPC, so that is typically if you may. Do that if for a variety of reasons, if at all, that's how you write your server. But you will return typically an error message or an error code back to the client saying that this cannot execute for whatever reason. So you will not wait.
The client for the next, if it wants a service to be executed again, the client waits till that service is called.
Okay. So now you are asking how the application is written. That's really up to the programmer, right? I mean, you have to decide what you want from the application. Do you want to retry after some time or do you want to just pop an error message to the end user? It's up to the application designer. Right? So the RPC semantics or the RPC system doesn't preclude you from just trying once, trying as many times as you want. All of that is up to the programmer. Okay, so that's all we have to say about RPCs. I'm going to start talking about RMIs next. Are there any questions on this?
How the yes. Previous
handle
is asynchronous. What
are
the client classes?
Yes, so that's a good question. So issue is how is the server going to deal with client crashes in asynchronous RPCs? So you can do the same thing like what I was talking about on the previous slide. So here is think of this as a long-running computation. Right. So you could assign an expiration time, maybe this takes 10 minutes. You could have expiration time and periodically the RPC runtime system can check. Is the client alive? Does it want the result? And if so, you keep computing until you generate a result. So all of the things we said are still valid. Doesn't depend on whether it's synchronous or asynchronous. Okay, so you just want to make sure that the client is alive and there are those mechanisms we discussed. There's a question here.
I was thinking if... So the server replies back with the results, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if there's one more RPC in between this time that crashes into the server, so what happens? Is it wait for the reply or does it send it up?
Okay. So, question is if you have made an RPC call, you're computing and can you make another RPC call, you have to wait for a reply. Since you're in asynchronous mode, what is being done here is not specified. It's really up to the application. The application can make other RPC calls to this server, to some other server, can do arbitrary computation.
Okay.
Right. The return value has to specify what is the return value for, which RPC call does it correspond to. So this the RPC system has to tell you. Otherwise, if you just get some arbitrary return value and you have three outstanding RPC requests, you will not know. Okay, so the assumption is if you return some results, there's a way for you to correlate the return to the call. Okay, this may be through some unique ID or sequence number or some such thing. But that does not preclude you from making multiple RPC requests, which may all be outstanding.
So it keeps piling up.
it can keep piling up. And as this does not even say when the reply comes back, doesn't mean that the replies have to even come back in the same order. Okay? Some RPC calls may be longer than others, so you can get a later reply first.
Just have a question. What would be a good application of such a system with asynchronous RPCs where you just want to respond threads on the server?
So question is, what could be a good application? So the same thing that we were talking about when we talked about server design, whether you had concurrent, multi-threaded or single-threaded, event-based.
Yeah.
So if you want to write a concurrent client which is event-based, this is better because it's basically not blocking for long periods of time. It's just basically just waiting for an acknowledgement. You can continue doing something and in the meantime until your replies come back. Okay, so any application that you want to use for this purpose, you can do. So this doesn't mean that one model is necessarily more powerful than the other. Both are equivalent. Any code that you can write with one, you can write with the other. Okay. So just a question of, if client is multi-threaded, there is no reason really to use any asynchronous RPCs. You can just have a thread that's blocked, other threads can compute. The client can make process. If client is single-threaded and you want to have the same effect as concurrency, then you want to use asynchronous calls wherever possible, including for RPCs. Any high performance system that has to squeeze out every bit of performance uses asynchronous. But as I had mentioned, it makes debugging applications harder because you have to take interrupts and you jump from one place to another. Okay. So let's move on to the next topic, which is remote method invocations or RMIs. Yeah, if you have done any Java programming, you may have used this again. So the goal here is to try to understand two things. One is, again, how RMI systems are built, not how they are used. And the second is, in particular, what is the difference between RPCs and RMIs. So think of this as RPCs in the object-oriented world. Okay, so RPCs apply to objects. So you can assume that there are classes that provide you object-oriented abstractions. A class is basically a module with some data and methods. Okay, the methods are operations that you can perform on the data. It belongs to the class. Okay. So typically in any object-oriented language, you have this notion of a separation between interface and implementation. Okay. The interface for an object or a class specifies what are the methods that you can invoke from the class. What are the methods that are exported by this class that some other objects or classes can invoke. Okay. So that's the specification of the class. The implementation is simply the code that implements those routines. Okay. There is this clean separation, and it's actually even more useful in the RMI world, as we will see. Okay. And here is the reason why, because you can even have the interface on one machine and the implementation on another. Okay. Because they are separated, there is no reason to put them all in the same process, and that's what we will see is the way RMIs are implemented. Okay. So one big difference that we will talk about in the context of RMIs is you can actually pass objects or parameters by reference. Okay. I said that in the context of RPCs, you don't typically pass pointers, okay, because you can't dereference a pointer on some random machine. So you don't do that. You don't pass parameters by reference for the same reason, okay, because you cannot provide access to that object of to that data structure on some different machine. RMIs relax this assumption. They allow you to pass by reference. Okay? And we'll see what needs to be done to make that happen. So let's first talk about how this whole notion works. So think of it as distributed objects. So rather than having an object and some code that calls the object all residing on the same machine, you have separated the two. The code for the object resides on some machine. The code that calls the object resides on some other machine. Exactly the same as RPCs. Okay, the server code is on one machine. The client code is on another machine. Okay. So you have this notion of distributed objects. Okay, and the concepts are very similar to RPCs. So this is your server machine. That's the client machine. That's the server code. That's the object. Yeah, that some other machine or some other code can call. The boxes are methods on the object. So what is shown in this box is the interface that this object exports. These are all the methods that are visible to other objects, whether they are residing on this machine or elsewhere. Yeah, that's what you are exporting. Okay. So on the client machine, you have to first bind yourself to a distributed object. Exactly what you did when you bound to a server in the RPC world, you have to do the same thing here. Okay. So the stubs in here are called the proxy and the skeleton. Okay. The skeleton is the name for the server stub. The proxy is the name for the client stub. Okay. So they perform the same function. So the proxy, whenever the first method is called on this distributed object, first loads the interface for this object. It does this by binding itself to that object, calls the stub on the server side and says, give me the interface for this object so I know what methods are exported by this object. Okay, so you fetch that, and then that interface, that box here is exactly a copy of that one, appears here. Okay, so that's called a skeleton. Okay, you get a skeleton of the object over. That's just the interface of the object. The code still stays there. The skeleton appears at the client end. And then you know what methods this object exposes, and then you can call all of those methods. And everything we talked about last time still has to happen here. All the communication between the client and the server is the job of the stub. Okay? The programmer doesn't deal with that. Okay? Marshalling of arguments, again, performed by the proxy and the stub at the server end. Okay? All of that remains the same. The only difference is the code is now written in a more object-oriented fashion. Okay, so I already mentioned all of this. So the proxy is the client stub. It maintains the server ID, which is the IP address, the endpoint, which is the port number, and the object ID, which is like the program number. Okay. It deals with setting up connections with the server. Again, it's up to the implementation to decide which protocol you use, if you want to use TCP or whether you want to use UDP. Typically in the Java world, you used TCP. Okay. You do serialization, which is marshalling and demarshalling of arguments. Okay. And I said that interface can be downloaded and constructed on the fly. Okay. Typically in the RPC world, the interface is pre-specified. Okay. So if you remember, I showed you this slide where you use the spec and that generates a header file and some stub, and that is linked into the application. This is done at compile time, okay, to ensure that all the bindings are resolved and so on. Okay. In the Java world, you don't need to do that. Okay. You can actually call an object that you didn't know existed at when you wrote the program, and the interface is dynamically imported. Okay. And this flexibility comes to you because object-oriented languages are not necessarily compiled languages. They can be, but they are not, like Java is not compiled in, so you can actually load new interfaces on the fly and link to them on the fly. Okay, in C, if there are some things you cannot resolve at compile time, you will not even be able to generate a binary. So you couldn't find the code for these variables or couldn't link to this library, and it'll not work. Okay, because this is done in the Java world, you can download the interface on the fly, not have to know about it at application writing time. Okay, the server stub is simple. It does the same thing as in the RPC system. Okay. So there are two ways of binding a client to a server or a client to an object. One is implicit and the other one is explicit. Okay. In the implicit case, the first time you invoke a method on the object, the runtime system will go and bind to that object. It will go do a directory lookup, get the object endpoint and bind to it. That's here. Okay, so you just declare a distributed object reference. Okay, and then you do something. You call a method on that object. Then you just bind. This is the first invocation of that method. In the explicit case, you declare an object and then you call the bind call to bind to it. Okay. You still don't have to specify any IP address or anything like that. Okay. But you do have to call this bind saying I want to bind to that object. At this point you import the interface for this object. Okay. From this the skeleton comes over. Okay. So that's explicit or implicit. Different RMS systems do it differently, but either way you have to bind, okay, whether it's explicit or not. Okay. The big difference between RPC systems and RMS system is that here you can pass objects by reference. In specifically what happens in Java. Okay, so when it says Java, this is the more general statement, and this is what is done in the Java case. Okay, so support system-wide object references. Java in particular passes local objects by value and remote objects by reference. Okay, so if you call a method and you specify a local object and a remote object as parameters to this method, the local object is passed by value. You actually make a copy and send it over. The remote object, you don't make a copy. The remote, you basically just pass a reference and the other end is going to refer to it. So here's a picture. It looks complicated, but it's not very. There are basically three machines, A, B, and C. This is the client machine. This is the server machine. This is the third machine that has a remote object that is used in the computation between the client and the server. Okay, so the remote object is O2, local object is O1. This is the server end. So here you basically make an RMI call, okay, and you specify a local object and a remote object as parameters. So you specify O1 and O2 as your parameters. You say foo O1 comma O2. Okay. What the RMI system will do is it will make a copy of the local object and send it with the message. So this is the copy that appears at the server machine because you pass the object by value. Okay. The remote object only pass a reference. This is equivalent to sending a pointer to the remote object using your message. Yeah. So all you have done is you send a pointer to the to that object in your message. So when the message arrives here, you now have a pointer to the remote object. So if you want to dereference this remote object, you have to do the equivalent of chasing a network pointer or dereferencing over a network. Okay. So this reference should include the machine where the object resides, the endpoint, where this object, how it can be accessed, all of that has to be specified in the message that came from the client to the server. Okay, that's the only way you can go and dereference that remote object or access its data or call its methods. Yes, question here.
When it says an object, does it send a shallow copy? So it does send all of the objects and sub-objects?
So what's the question?
When it sends a copy of an object, does it send a shallow copy or a deep copy?
Does it send a shallow copy or a deep copy? I'm not sure exactly what happens in Java. In general, you expect that anything you could do with the object here, you should be able to do there. So you should
pass the other objects by reference to your machine, it just doesn't need them or something.
The optimizations are certainly possible, but whatever you do, you want to make sure that if you send pass by value, those semantics are preserved. If you pass by value and you change a copy of, change something that is in that object, but you pass that by reference, you're going to modify it here. So that's not really passing by value. So whatever your RMI system is, I look up what is done in case of Java. I don't know that answer offhand. But what only thing I want to point out is if you say pass by value, your programmer will assume that whatever you do with this copy here, there's nothing that is going to get reflected back there. So if you provide those semantics, you better respect those semantics. You can't pass some things by value and the other things are references. Then you make some changes there, then they inadvertently you change state here. So you don't want that confusion. No, but I'll look that up and get back to you about what is done in Java in particular. Java doesn't do it.
Reference and dereference over a network. I mean, until and unless you map an interface of the client to the server or either way, so it's not going to work right without pointers.
No, so you don't need to. Pointers are not visible to the programmer. Okay? But what you are doing conceptually when you pass by reference is you are passing, think of it as you are passing a reference which is equivalent to a pointer. So you know where the object resides and you can go and modify its state. Okay?
But you know where the object resides on the local system, right? Like for machine A,
yes.
It says that you're passing a remote reference to R1.
Yes.
So that basically means you know where R1 resides on that machine, but for the other machine, it's not this.
No. So in this case also, you only had a pointer, because that's what this is doing. This is a remote reference. You just passed a reference to O2. Okay? But regardless, it doesn't matter. Conceptually, you are saying, how do you pass by reference? That's the real question you are asking, right? So the way you pass by reference is, it's equivalent of passing a pointer, but this is an object. So you have to basically encapsulate all the information you need to go and when you dereference it, to access that object, methods on that object, data of that object. Okay, so you might actually have associate an identifier with the object that you can actually hand back to the program, and then so you can take that name of the object, convert that into an ID, or you can specify a memory address. So these are the only two ways to do it. Right? So typically you probably may do the former, just associate a unique ID for that object and pass that with the program endpoint. So then you come back and says, I want to access that object, and you can do it. Okay, so that's how it is typically done. Any other questions here? Okay, so that is the Java world. So there are many implementations of RMI, and here is another example. Okay, this is how distributed objects are implemented in this system called DCE. Okay, Distributed Computing Environment is what it stands for. No longer in use, but it was something that was being built by IBM, what used to be Digital and now is actually HP, long time back. Okay, so what they were trying to do at that point was build a standardized middleware that anybody could use to write distributed applications. They were called as distributed computing environment. And one of the services DCE provided was that of a RMI. So you could basically write objects code, and then you could invoke that object code from some other machine and write distributed application. So it was a middleware which basically functions in this case, only functions exactly like an RMI system, but DCE has more to it than just RMI. It had a distributed file system, it had many other services that it implemented. But for the purpose of today's class, we are only interested in its object model. So what it does are actually, it has the notion of a private object and it has a notion of a shared object. Okay? The interesting thing is, what are private objects? So private objects, if you write a client server application using what are called private objects, the code on the server functions similar to using threads. Okay? Every time a client makes a request, a new copy of the object is created. Potentially a new thread is created for that request, and that client request services that that server thread services that client request using this copy of the object. Okay, this is the code it uses, and there's a thread associated with it. When the request finishes, this object is thrown away, the thread is terminated. Okay, so this is an object and a thread per request model. There's no global state you can keep when you have this. Okay, so think of it, if you are doing HTTP processing, your HTTP processing code could be an object. Every time a request comes in, you create a copy of the object, which is all the code that you need to parse the request, get back the files from the file system, construct a response and send it back. Okay, so that is the code for your object. So you get your own code, you execute in the context of that code, and you send back a reply, and the object is thrown away. So this is how you can process multiple concurrent requests, each of which has its own state in its own private object. Okay. The other object is basically a single named object. This is what we have assumed in the Java world. There's only one. So each client makes a request on that named object, and you don't create a copy. You just execute in the context of that object. So all of the state is shared across this client. So if it has data in that object, one method call modifies that state, another subsequent call will see this change state. Okay. This is the same thing we have assumed here. Right. So in this remote reference, both this machine and this machine have a reference to that object. So if you make a call from here to here and modify the state, it subsequently machine C makes a call there, you will see the modified state. Because it's the same object, the same code, the same data shared across. So that is basically what is in the DC world called a named or a shared object. Okay, but there is this other abstraction that they also provide, which is a notion of a private object. Any questions on this? Okay, so coming back to Java, and specifically Java RMI, again I will show some sample code next time. So the concept is somewhat similar to the RPC gen system that I was showing earlier. The server has to define an interface and implement the methods that are defined. Yeah, and the server program, it has to create the server object, and first thing it does is it has to go and register itself, okay, with the remote object registry. This is very similar to a directory service. Keeps track of all the remote objects that the server, the directory knows about. The client has to look up the server in that registry. It's similar. Do a directory lookup, and then you import the interface, and then you basically can make method calls on that remote object, you know, when you have the interface. Okay. There are all these tools that you have. There's RMI registry. That's the server side name server of the directory service. There is RMIC, which is like which is equivalent to RMI, not RMI, RPC gen. It creates the client and the server stub code for you. Okay. So you can use these tools to write RMI programs in Java. There's another important difference to keep in mind. Not really a difference, but something that is more important in Java, because in Java, synchronization or locks are part of the language. In RPC system, they are not. If you have services that are accessed concurrently and they have global state, your server has to implement locking to ensure that only one client request can modify the state or read the state at any given time. So the burden of writing mutually exclusion or implementing mutual exclusion is left to the programmer. In case of Java, this is already a part of the language. Specifically, any Java class or any Java object can use locking if you use the keyword synchronized. If you have used it, all you have to do is use synchronized keyword. And then what this ensures is only one Java thread can execute any method of that class at any time. Any other thread that tries to access this method is blocked until the first one finishes. So that raises the issue of how should Java handle concurrent requests that are coming over a network rather than concurrent requests that are being made from this program itself. So that's what is being said here. Java supports this notion of a monitor. If you know what a monitor is, it's basically a lock that protects the entire object. If you have a monitor, then this only one thread or only one method of this object can be invoked at any time. And if some object or some method is being executed, no one else can access either the data or the methods of that object. Okay. That's what a monitor does. Now the question is, since now you have RMIs, how should this notion be extended out to client application? Okay. If one client is called a distributed object, and you use the keyword synchronized on the distributed object, this request is executing. What should happen to the second request? Okay. Should it block? So clearly it has to block. Right? So that is a given. But should it block at the client or should it block at the server? Right? So there are these two options. If you block at the server, then the client stub code is trivial. It is not doing anything. It is just sending the request over, and the server stub has to serialize or sequentialize the execution. Okay, so if you could use a first come first serve, first request goes in, it's executing any subsequent request, basically queue up there. Okay. Client is simple in this case. Okay. But then you have to deal with the issue of client crashing. Okay, so if the client is crashed and there's a request waiting, that's going to be a problem. Okay. The other option is you block at the client end. So you don't even send the request to the server. You block at the client, and all the clients basically have to implement some other external distributed locking mechanism. Okay. So the clients have to know about each other and say this is the order in which we access the server. Okay. And then one of them gets to go and the others block. Okay. So you use the notion of a distributed lock. Okay. This is something we will study in the next chapter, how to implement a distributed lock. But if you want to block at the proxy, then the RMI system has to implement a distributed lock in the proxy code. Okay, so then you can serialize access to the distributed object from the proxy end. So only one request even appears at the client server at any given time. Okay. Now it so happens that Java actually uses proxies for blocking. Okay, but it leaves it to the application to implement distributed locks. In other words, Java is not going to do anything at the server stuff. You are supposed to deal with this at the client end, okay? But it doesn't by itself do this for you. Okay? Although it could, but it doesn't. It leaves it to the application. You are the application designer. you know best the semantics of your application. So you coordinate using application code and decide in what order should these client machines access this serialized object, or rather not serialized, synchronized object. So the burden of implementing the lock is actually on the programmer in this case, not that's the design decision that Java has made. Okay. Again, we'll come to how to implement a distributed lock later. Okay. But you have to have this notion of a lock that's distributed across machines. Any questions? Okay. So I have 5 minutes. I'm just going to talk a little bit about sockets and stop. We'll talk about MPIs next time. Okay. So we talked about RPCs, we talked about RMIs. Okay. So I'm assuming that most of you know something about sockets, but if not, I have 2 slides just to quickly tell you how do you write a client and server application using sockets. One of these 3 things you will probably use for your first programming assignment, okay, because it will involve some notion of distributed application. So you have to figure out how are you going to communicate between components of your application. Either you will use vanilla sockets or you will use RPCs or RMIs. Okay, one of these 3 things you have to use. 2 of those 3 we have covered. So this is basically just writing an application using just a low level socket interface. Okay. So all of the work in the case of socket you have to do. You have to basically set up a connection, you have to connect to the server, you have to send your request, get the response back. So this is all done by the programmer, and typically the communication part of the code works as follows. This is the server process, this is the client process. You use a socket system call to create an endpoint. Both the client and server have to create an endpoint. Okay. The server will then bind the endpoint. It will bind it to a port number. Okay. HTTP process will bind the socket to port 80. Okay. So you have to pick a port number and then you have to bind it. Okay. Once you have bound the socket to an endpoint, okay, then you basically call the listen call saying I am willing to now start receiving request on this socket. Okay, so you create an endpoint, you bind it to a port number, and then you start listening on the socket. Again, I'll show sample code that implements all of this. But here is how basically the flow works. So once you have done this, then you just call this accept call and you wait for a request to arrive from the client. At this point, the server process is up and running, has created a socket, is bound to it, is listening onto it, and is waiting for a request. And all the client has to do is it basically creates its own endpoint, and then you call the connect call, the connect system call, and then you basically connect to this server. Okay? If this is a TCP connection, when you create an endpoint, you have to specify whether you want to use TCP or UDP. If this is TCP, this is where the 3-way handshake is going to take place, okay, before the connection is established. If this is not TCP, then you just have to basically start sending at this point. Okay? So at this point, there's an actual connection has gotten established because this is waiting for a request, connects to the server. And then you can read and write onto the socket. Okay, it's a bidirectional channel. Can either read data or write data. Okay, so there's some number of reads and writes will occur on this socket. This is the actual communication. Okay, so you have to create your own message format. Okay, when if you send a string, the server better know what the string means. Okay, so all of the parsing of the message, everything. So this is a very low level interface. You have to define what sense to make of the messages and what not. What protocol are you using? So all that you have to decide. Sockets are just a pipe that allows you to send bits at one end and it will appear at the other end. What you do with the bits is up to the application. Okay? Unlike RPCs where you just specify a call and the message actually says this is what you want to do, all of that you will have to decide and write on top of this, all of this. So anyway, you do some number of reads and writes and then you call close, at which point the connection is torn down. Okay? So if you use vanilla socket, this is the structure of what your client and the server. Okay, and then on top of this, you have to write the application itself. Okay, so that's basically all these methods are described here. Okay, so again, since I will not talk about MPIs now, the only thing I want to mention is that all of these are blocking calls. Okay, a read is a blocking call. if you read from a socket and there is no data has arrived yet, you will block. The server will block until the client sends data. Okay. So this is something to keep in mind, because the MPI's interface actually takes this notion of synchronous blocking calls and allows you to also do asynchronous communication. So it's a more flexible implementation of what these sockets do. And by sockets, we mean the Berkeley implementation of sockets, which is what you find on any Unix or a POSIX system. Okay? Any questions on this? I'm assuming at least some of you have seen socket code, right? But for others, it may be new. Okay, so let's end here. Again, the thing to keep in mind is this programming assignment is not going to specify what system to use. Okay, it's not even going to specify what programming language to use. That's really up to you. Okay, you have to decide whether you want to use RPCs, RMI, sockets, whichever one you are most familiar with, comfortable with, or want to learn, you can pick. Okay, so that's all left to you. I'm just specifying what each of this can do for you. Okay, so let's stop here. Next time I'll bring some sample code and I'll also hand out the first programming assignment.